Disc 6.
Chapter 17. You say somebody has been trying to poison me? Carrie Louise's voice held bewilderment and disbelief. You know, she said, I can't really believe it. She waited a few moments, her eyes half closed. Louis said gently, I wish I could have spared you this, dearest. Almost absently, she stretched out a hand to him, and he took it. Miss Marple, sitting close by, shook her head sympathetically. Carrie Louise opened her eyes. Is it really true, Jane? She asked. I'm afraid so, my dear. Then everything... Carrie Louise broke off. She went on. I've always thought I knew what was real and what wasn't. But this doesn't seem real. But it is. So, maybe I'm wrong everywhere. But who could want to do such a thing to me? I mean, nobody in this house would want to kill me. Her voice still held incredulity. That's what I would have thought, said Louis. I was wrong. And Christiane knew about it? That explains it. Explains what? Asked Louis. His manner, said Carrie Louise. It was very odd, you know. Not at all his usual self. He seemed upset about me, and as though he was wanting to say something to me and then not saying it. And he asked me if my heart was strong, and if I'd been well lately, were trying to hint to me, perhaps. But why not say something straight out? It's so much simpler just to say straight out. He didn't want to cause you pain, Caroline. Pain? But why? Oh, I see. Her eyes widened. So, that's what you believe. But you're wrong, Louis. Quite wrong. I can assure you of that. Her husband avoided her eyes. I'm sorry, said Mrs. Sericold after a moment or two. But I can't believe anything of what has happened lately is true. Edgar shooting at you, Gina and Stephen, that ridiculous box of chocolates, it just isn't true. Nobody spoke. Caroline Louise Sericold sighed. I suppose, she said, that I must have lived outside reality for a long time. Please, both of you, I think I would like to be alone. I've got to try and understand. Miss Marple came down the stairs into the great hall to find Alex Resterick standing near the large arched entrance door with his hand flung out in a somewhat flamboyant gesture. Come in, come in, said Alex happily, and as though he were the owner of the great hall. I'm just thinking about last night. Louis Sericold, who had followed Miss Marple down from Carrie Louise's sitting room, crossed the great hall to his study and went in and shut the door. Are you trying to reconstruct the crime? Asked Miss Marple with subdued eagerness. Eh? Alex looked at her with a frown. Then his brow cleared. Oh, that, he said. No, not exactly. I was looking at the whole thing from an entirely different point of view. I was thinking of this place in terms of the theatre. Not reality, but artificiality. Just come over here. Now, think of it in the terms of a stage set. Lighting, entrances, exits. Dramatis personae. Noises off. All very interesting. Not all my own idea. The inspector gave it to me. I think he's rather a cruel man. He did his best to frighten me this morning. And did he frighten you? Well, I'm not sure. Alex described the inspector's experiment and the timing of the performance of the puffing Constable Dodgett. Time, he said, is so very misleading. One thinks things take such a long time, but really, of course, they don't. No, said Miss Marple. Representing the audience, she moved to a different position. The stage set now consisted of a vast tapestry-covered wall going up to dimness, with a grand piano up left and a window and window seat up right. Very near the window seat was the door to the library. The piano stool was only about 8 feet from the door into the square lobby which led to the corridor. Two very convenient exits. The audience, of course, had an excellent view of both of them. But last night there had been no audience. Nobody, that is to say, had been facing the stage set that Miss Marple was now facing. The audience last night had been sitting with their backs to that particular stage. How long, Miss Marple wondered, would it have taken to slip out of the room, run along the corridor, shoot Gulbranson, and come back? Not nearly so long as one would think. Measured in minutes and seconds, a very short time indeed. What had Carrie Louise meant when she had said to her husband, "So that's what you believe, but you're wrong, Louis." I must say that that was a very penetrating remark of the inspector's, Alex's voice cut in on her meditations, about a stage set being real, made of wood and cardboard and stuck together with glue and as real on the unpainted as on the painted side. The illusion, he pointed out, is in the eyes of the audience. Like conjurers, Miss Marple murmured vaguely. They do it with mirrors, is, I believe, the slang phrase. Stephen Resterick came in, slightly out of breath. Oh, hello, Alex, he said. That little rat, Ernie Gregg. I don't know if you remember him. The one who played Festy when you did Twelfth Night. Quite a bit of talent there, I thought. Yes, he's got talent of a sort. Very good with his hands, too. Does a lot of our carpentry. However, that's neither here nor there. He's been boasting to Gina that he gets out at night and wanders about the grounds. Says he was wandering round last night and boasts he saw something. Alex spun round. Saw what? Says he's not going to tell. Actually, I'm pretty certain he's only trying to show off and get into the limelight. He's an awful liar. But I thought perhaps he ought to be questioned. Alex said sharply, I should leave him for a bit. Don't let him think we're too interested. Perhaps, yes, I think you might be right there. This evening, perhaps. Stephen went on into the library. Miss Marple, moving gently round the hall in her character of mobile audience, collided with Alex Resterick as he stepped back suddenly. Miss Marple said, I'm so sorry. Alex frowned at her in a sort of absent way. I beg your pardon. And then added in a surprised voice, Oh, it's you. It seemed to Miss Marple an odd remark for someone with whom she had been conversing for some considerable time. Now, I was thinking about something else, said Alex Resterick. That boy, Ernie. He made vague motions with both hands. Then, with a sudden change of manner, he crossed the hall and went through the library door, shutting it behind him. The murmur of voices came from behind the closed door, but Miss Marple hardly noticed them. She was uninterested in the versatile Ernie and what he had seen or pretended to see. She had a shrewd suspicion that Ernie had seen nothing at all. She did not believe for a moment that on a raw, cold, foggy night like last night, Ernie would have troubled to use his lock-picking activities and wander about in the park. In all probability, he had never got out at night, boasting. That was all it had been. Like Johnny Backhouse, thought Miss Marple, who always had a good storehouse of parallels to draw upon, selected from the inhabitants of St. Mary Mead. "I seen you last night," had been Johnny Backhouse's unpleasant taunt to all he thought it might affect. It had been a surprisingly successful remark. So many people, Miss Marple reflected, have been in places where they are anxious not to be seen. She dismissed Johnny from her mind and concentrated on a vague something which Alex's account of Inspector Curry's remarks had stirred to life. Those remarks had given Alex an idea. She was not sure that they had not given her an idea, too. The same idea, or a different one? She stood where Alex Resterick had stood. She thought to herself, this is not a real hall. This is only cardboard and canvas and wood. This is a stage scene. Scrappy phrases flashed across her mind. Illusion in the eyes of the audience. They do it with mirrors. Bowls of goldfish, yards of coloured ribbon, vanishing ladies, all the panoply and misdirection of the conjurer's art. Something stirred in her consciousness, a picture. Something that Alex had said, something that he had described to her. Constable Dodgett puffing and panting. Panting. Something shifted in her mind, came suddenly into focus. Why, of course, said Miss Marple. That must be it. Chapter 18.
Oh, Wally, how you startled me.
Gina, emerging from the shadows by the theatre, jumped back a little as the figure of Wally Hudd materialised out of the gloom. It was not yet quite dark, but had that eerie half-light when objects lose their reality and take on the fantastic shapes of nightmare.
What are you doing down here? You never come near the theatre as a rule.
Maybe I was looking for you, Gina. It's usually the best place to find you, isn't it? Wally's soft, faintly drawling voice held no special insinuation, yet Gina flinched a little.
It's a job, and I'm keen on it. I like the atmosphere of paint and canvas and backstage generally.
Yes, it means a lot to you. I've seen that. Tell me, Gina, how long do you think it'll be before this business is all cleared up?
Well, the inquest's tomorrow. It'll be just adjourned for a fortnight, something like that. At least that's what Inspector Curry gave us to understand.
A fortnight, said Wally thoughtfully. I see. Say, 3 weeks, perhaps? And after that, we're free. I'm going back to the States, then.
Oh, but I can't rush off like that, cried Gina. I couldn't leave Grand Am. And we've got these two new productions we're working on.
I didn't say we. I said I was going. Gina stopped and looked up at her husband. Something in the effect of the shadows made him seem very big. A big, quiet figure. And in some way, or so it seemed to her, faintly menacing, standing over her, threatening. What?
Do you mean, she hesitated, you don't want me to come?
Why, no, I didn't say that.
You don't care if I come or not, is that it?
She was suddenly angry. I see here, Gina. This is where we've got to have a showdown. We didn't know much about each other when we got married, not much about each other's backgrounds, not much about the other one's folks. We thought it didn't matter. We thought nothing mattered except having a swell time together. Well,
Stage one is over. Your folks didn't and don't think much of me. Maybe they're right. I'm not their kind. But if you think I'm staying on here, kicking my heels and doing odd jobs in what I consider is just a crazy setup, well, think again. I want to live in my own country, doing the kind of job I want to do and can do. My idea of a wife is the kind of wife who used to go along with the old pioneers, ready for anything. Hardship, unfamiliar country, danger, strange surroundings. Well, perhaps that's too much to ask of you. But it's that or nothing. Maybe I hustled you into marriage. If so, you better get free of me and start again. It's up to you. If you prefer one of these arty boys, well, it's your life, and you've got to choose. But I'm going home. I think you're an absolute pig, said Gina. I'm enjoying myself here. Is that so? Well, I'm not. You even enjoy murder, I suppose. Gina drew in her breath sharply. That's a cruel and wicked thing to say. I was very fond of Uncle Christian. And don't you realize that someone has been quietly poisoning Grandam for months? It's horrible. And I told you, I didn't like it here. I don't like the kind of things that go on. I'm quitting. If you're allowed to. Don't you realize you'll probably be arrested for Uncle Christian's murder? I hate the way Inspector Curry looks at you. He's just like a cat watching a mouse with nasty, sharp, clawed paw all ready to pounce. Just because you were out of the hall fixing those lights and because you're not English. I'm sure they're going to go fastening it on you. They'll need some evidence first. Gina wailed. Oh, I'm frightened for you, Wally. I've been frightened all along. It's no good being scared. I tell you, they've got nothing on me. They walked in silence towards the house. Gina said, I don't believe you really want me to come back to America with you. Walter Hutt did not answer. Gina Hutt turned on him and stamped her foot. I hate you. I hate you. You are horrible. A beast. A cruel, unfeeling beast. After all I've tried to do for you. You want to be rid of me. You don't care if you never see me again. Well, I don't care if I never see you again. I was a stupid little fool ever to marry you. And I shall get a divorce as soon as possible, and I shall marry Stephen or Alex. And be much happier than I ever could be with you. And I hope you go back to the States and marry some horrible girl who'll make you really miserable.
Fine, said Wally. Now we know where we are.
Miss Marple saw Gina and Wally go into the house together. She was standing at the spot where Inspector Curry had made his experiment with Constable Dodgett earlier in the afternoon. Miss Belliver's voice behind her made her jump.
You'll get a chill, Miss Marple, standing about like that after the sun's gone down.
Miss Marple fell meekly into step with her, and they walked briskly to the house.
I was thinking about conjuring tricks, said Miss Marple. It's so difficult when you're watching them to see how they're done, and yet once they're explained, so absurdly simple. Although even now I can't imagine how conjurers produce bowls of goldfish. Did you ever see The Lady Who Is Sawn in Half? It's such a thrilling trick. It fascinated me when I was 11 years old, I remember, and I never could think how it was done. But the other day there was an article in some paper giving the whole thing away. Now, I don't think a newspaper should do that, do you? It seems it's not one girl, but two. The head of one and the feet of the other. You think it's one girl, and it's really two. And the other way round would work equally well, wouldn't it?
Miss Belliver looked at her with faint surprise. Miss Marple was not often so fluffy and incoherent as this. It's all been too much for the old lady, she thought.
When you only look at one side of a thing, you only see one side, continued Miss Marple. But everything fits in perfectly well if you can only make up your mind what is reality and what is illusion. She added abruptly, Is Carrie Louise all right?
Yes, said Miss Belliver. She's all right, but it must have been a shock, you know, finding out that someone wanted to kill her. I mean, particularly a shock to her, because she doesn't understand violence.
Carrie Louise understands something that we don't, said Miss Marple thoughtfully. She always has.
Well, I know what you mean. But she doesn't live in the real world.
Doesn't she? Miss Beliver looked at her in surprise.
There never was a more unworldly person than Kara.
You don't think that perhaps... Miss Marple broke off as Edgar Lawson passed them, swinging along at a great pace. He gave a kind of shamefaced nod, but averted his face as he passed.
"I've remembered now who he reminds me of," said Miss Marple. "It came to me suddenly just a few moments ago. He reminds me of a young man called Leonard Wiley. His father was a dentist, but he got old and blind, and his hand used to shake, and so people preferred to go to the sun. But the old man was very miserable about it, and moped, and said he was no good for anything any more. And Leonard, who was very soft-hearted and rather foolish, began to pretend he drank more than he should. He always smelt of whiskey, and used to sham being rather fuddled when his patients came. His idea was that they'd go back to the father again, and say the younger man was no good.
And did they? Well, of course not, said Miss Marple. What happened was what anybody with any sense could have told him would happen. The patients went to Mr. Riley, the rival dentist. So many people with good hearts have no sense.
Besides, Leonard Wiley was so unconvincing. His idea of drunkenness wasn't in the least like real drunkenness. He overdid the whiskey, spilling it on his clothes, you know, to a perfectly impossible extent.
They went into the house by the side door. Chapter 19. Inside the house, they found the family assembled in the library. Lewis was walking up and down, and there was an air of general tension in the atmosphere.
"Was anything the matter?" asked Miss Beliver.
Lewis said shortly, "Andy Gregg is missing from roll call tonight."
"Has he run away?"
"Oh, we don't know. Maverick and some of the staff are searching the ground. If we cannot find him, we must communicate with the police."
"Grandam!"
Gina ran over to Carrie Louise, startled by the whiteness of her face.
"You look ill."
"Well, I am unhappy. The poor boy." Lewis said, "I was going to question him this evening as to whether he had seen anything noteworthy last night. I have the offer of a good post for him, and I thought that after discussing that I would bring up the other topic. Now," he broke off. Miss Marple murmured softly, "Foolish boy, poor foolish boy." She shook her head, and Mrs. Sericold said gently, "So you think so too, Jane?" Stephen Resterick came in. He said,
"I missed you at the theatre, Gina. I thought you said you'd... Hello? What's up?"
Lewis repeated his information, and as he finished speaking, Dr. Maverick came in with a fair-haired boy with pink cheeks and a suspiciously angelic expression. Miss Marple remembered his being at dinner on the night she had arrived at Stonygates.
"I've brought Arthur Jenkins along," said Dr. Maverick. "He seems to have been the last person to talk to Ernie."
"Now, Arthur," said Lewis Sericold, "please help us if you can. Now, where has Ernie gone? Is this just a prank?"
"Well, I don't know, sir. Straight, I don't. Didn't say nothing to me, it didn't. Awful of the play at the theatre he was, that's all. Said as how he'd had a smashing idea for the scenery, what Mrs. Adam and Mr. Stephen thought was first class."
"There's another thing, Arthur. Ernie claims he was prowling about the grounds after lock-up last night. Was that true?"
"Of course it ain't. Just boasting, that's all. Perishing liar, Ernie.
He never got out at night. He supposed he could, but he wasn't that good with locks. He couldn't do anything with a lock that was a lock. Anyway, he was in last night, that I don't know.
You're not saying that just to satisfy us, Arthur?
No, cross my heart, said Arthur virtuously. Lewis did not look quite satisfied.
Listen, said Dr. Maverick. What's that?
A murmur of voices was approaching. The door was flung open, and looking very pale and ill, the spectacled Mr. Baumgarten staggered in. He gasped out, "We found him. Them. It's horrible."
He sank down on a chair and mopped his forehead.
Mildred Street said sharply, "What do you mean, found them?" Baumgarten was shaking all over.
"Down at the theatre," he said. "Their heads crushed in. The big counterweight must have fallen on them. Alex Resterick and that boy Ernie Gregg. They're both dead."
Chapter 20. "I've brought you a cup of strong soup, Carrie Louise," said Miss Marple. "Now please drink it." Mrs. Sericold sat up in the big carved oak four-poster bed. She looked very small and childlike. Her cheeks had lost their rose-pink flush, and her eyes had a curiously absent look. She took the soup obediently from Miss Marple. As she sipped it, Miss Marple sat down in a chair beside the bed.
"First Christian," said Carrie Louise, "and now Alex, and poor, sharp, silly little Ernie. Did he really know anything?"
"I don't think so," said Miss Marple. "He was just telling lies, making himself important by hinting that he had seen or knew something. The tragedy is that somebody believed his lies."
Carrie Louise shivered. Her eyes went back to their faraway look.
"We meant to do so much for these boys. We did do something, as some of them have done wonderfully well. Several of them are in really responsible positions. A few slid back, but that can't be helped. Modern civilized conditions are so complex. Too complex for some simple and undeveloped natures. You know Lewis's great scheme? He always felt that transportation was a thing that had saved many a potential criminal in the past. They were shipped overseas, and they made new lives in simpler surroundings. He wants to start a modern scheme on that basis. To buy up a great tract of territory or a group of islands, finance it for some years, make it a cooperative, self-supporting community, with everyone having a stake in it. But cut off, so that the early temptation to go back to cities and the bad old days can be neutralized. It's his dream. But it'll take a lot of money, of course, and there aren't many philanthropists with vision now. We want another Eric. Eric would have been enthusiastic."
Miss Marple picked up a little pair of scissors and looked at them curiously.
"What an odd pair of scissors," she said. "They've got two finger holes on one side and one on the other."
Carrie Louise's eyes came back from that frightening far distance. "Alex gave them to me this morning," she said. "They're supposed to make it easier to cut your right-hand nails."
"Dear boy. He was so enthusiastic. He made me try them then and there.
And I suppose he gathered up the nail clippings and took them tidily away," said Miss Marple.
"Yes," said Carrie Louise. "He..."
She broke off.
"Why did you say that?"
"I was thinking about Alex. He had brains."
"Yes, he had brains."
You mean that's why he died? I think so, yes. He and Ernie. It doesn't bear thinking about. When do they think it happened? Late this evening, between 6 and 7 o'clock, probably. After they'd knocked off work for the day? Yes. Gina had been down there that evening, and Wally Hudd. Stephen, too, said that he'd been down to look for Gina. Oh, but as far as that went, anybody could have... Miss Marple's train of thought was interrupted. Carrie Louise said quietly and unexpectedly, "How much do you know, Jane?" Miss Marple looked up sharply. The eyes of the two women met. Miss Marple said slowly, "If I was quite sure..." "I think you are sure, Jane." Jane Marple said slowly, "What do you want me to do?" Carrie leaned back against her pillows. "It is in your hands, Jane. You'll do what you think right." She closed her eyes. "Tomorrow," Miss Marple hesitated, "I shall have to try and talk to Inspector Curry. If he'll listen..." Chapter 21. Inspector Curry said rather impatiently, "Yes, Miss Marple?" "Could we, do you think, go into the Great Hall?" Inspector Curry looked faintly surprised. "Is that your idea of privacy? Surely in here..." He looked round the study. "It's not privacy I'm thinking of so much. It's something I want to show you. Something Alex Resterick made me see." Inspector Curry, stifling a sigh, got up and followed Miss Marple. "Somebody's been talking to you?" he suggested hopefully. "No," said Miss Marple. "It's not a question of what people have said. It's really a question of conjuring tricks. They do it with mirrors, you know, that sort of thing, if you understand me." Inspector Curry did not understand. He stared and wondered if Miss Marple was quite right in the head. Miss Marple took up her stand and beckoned the inspector to stand beside her. "I want you to think of this place as a stage set, Inspector, as it was on the night Christian Gulbrandsen was killed. You're here in the audience looking at the people on the stage. Mrs. Sericold and myself and Mrs. Street and Gina and Stephen. And just like on the stage, there are entrances and exits, and the characters go out to different places. Only you don't think when you're in the audience where they are really going to. They go out to the front door or to the kitchen, and when the door opens, you see a little bit of painted backcloth. But really, of course, they go out to the wings, or the back of the stage with carpenters and electricians and other characters waiting to come on. They go out to a different world."
"I don't quite see, Miss Marple."
"Oh, I know, I dare say it sounds very silly, but if you think of this as a play, and the scene is the Great Hall at Stony Gates, what exactly is behind the scene? I mean, what is backstage? The terrace, isn't it? The terrace, and a lot of windows opening onto it. And that, you see, is how the conjuring trick was done. It was the trick of the lady sawn in half that made me think of it."
"The lady sawn in half?" Inspector Curry was now quite sure that Miss Marple was a mental case.
"As a most thrilling conjuring trick. You must have seen it. Only not really one girl, but two girls. The head of one and the feet of the other. It looks like one person and is really two. And so I thought it could just as well be the other way about. Two people, could really be one person.
Two people, really one?
Inspector Curry looked desperate. Yes, not for long. How long did your constable take in the park to run to this house and back? 2 minutes and 45 seconds, wasn't it? This would be less than that. Well under 2 minutes.
What was under 2 minutes?
The conjuring trick. The trick when it wasn't two people, but one person. In there. In the study. We're only looking at the visible part of the stage. Behind the scenes, there is the terrace and a row of windows. So easy when there are two people in the study to open the study window, get out, run along the terrace, those footsteps Alex heard, in at the side door, shoot Christian Gulbrandsen and run back. And during that time, the other person in the study does both voices, so that we're all quite sure there are two people in there. And so there were most of the time, but not for that little period of under 2 minutes.
Inspector Curry found his breath and his voice. Do you mean it was Edgar Lawson who ran along the terrace and shot Gulbrandsen? Edgar Lawson who poisoned Mrs. Sericold?
But you see, Inspector, no one has been poisoning Mrs. Sericold at all. That's where the misdirection comes in. Someone very cleverly used the fact that Mrs. Sericold's sufferings from arthritis were not unlike the symptoms of arsenical poisoning. It's the old conjurer's trick of forcing a card on you. Quite easy to add arsenic to a bottle of tonic. Quite easy to add a few lines to a typewritten letter. But the real reason for Mr. Gulbrandsen's coming here was the most likely reason. Something to do with the Gulbrandsen Trust. Money, in fact. Suppose that there had been embezzlement. Embezzlement on a very big scale. You see where that points? To just one person? Inspector Curry gasped. Louis Sericold, he murmured incredulously. Louis Sericold, said Miss Marple.
Chapter 22. Part of a letter from Gina Hudd to her aunt, Mrs. Van Rydock. And so you see, darling Aunt Ruth, the whole thing has been just like a nightmare, especially the end of it. I've told you all about this funny man, Edgar Lawson. He always was a complete rabbit. And when the inspector began questioning him and breaking him down, he lost his nerve completely and scuttled like a rabbit. Just lost his nerve and ran. Literally ran. Jumped out of the window and round the house and down the drive, and then there was a policeman coming to head him off, and he swerved and ran full tilt for the lake. He leapt into a rotten old punt that's moulded there for years and pushed off. I mean, quite a mad and senseless thing to do, of course, but as I say, he was just a panic-stricken rabbit. And then Lewis gave a great shout and said, "That punt's rotten," and raced off to the lake, too. The punt went down, and there was Edgar struggling in the water. He couldn't swim. Lewis jumped in and swam out to him. He got to him, but they were both in difficulty because they'd got among the reeds. One of the inspector's men went in with a rope round him, but he got entangled too, and they had to pull him in. Aunt Mildred said, "They'll drown, they'll drown, they'll both drown," in a silly sort of way, and Grandam just said, "Yes." I can't describe to you just how she made that one word sound. Just yes, and it went through you like a sword. Am I just being silly and melodramatic? I suppose I am. But it did sound like that. And then, when it was all over, and they'd got them out and tried artificial respiration, but it was no good, and the inspector came to us and said to Grandam, "I'm afraid, Mrs. Sericold, there's no hope.
Grandam said very quietly, "Thank you, Inspector." Then she looked at us all. Me longing to help but not knowing how, and Jolly looking grim and tender and ready to minister as usual, and Stephen stretching out his hands, and funny old Miss Marple looking so sad and tired, and even Wally looking upset. All so fond of her, and wanting to do something. But Grandam just said, "Mildred." And Aunt Mildred said, "Mother." And they went away together into the house, Grandam looking so small and frail and leaning on Aunt Mildred. I never realized until then how fond of each other they were. It didn't show much, you know, but it was there all the time. Gina paused and sucked the end of her fountain pen. She resumed. "About me and Wally, we're coming back to the States as soon as we can." Chapter 23. "What made you guess, Jane?" Miss Marple took her time about replying. She looked thoughtfully at the other two, Carrie Louise thinner and frailer, and yet curiously untouched, and the old man with the sweet smile and the thick white hair, Dr. Galbraith, Bishop of Cromer. The bishop took Carrie Louise's hand in his. "Oh, this has been a great sorrow to you, my poor child, and a great shock."
"A sorrow, yes, but not really a shock."
"No," said Miss Marple. "That's what I discovered, you know. Everyone kept saying how Carrie Louise lived in another world from this and was out of touch with reality. But actually, Carrie Louise, it was reality you were in touch with, and not the illusion. You were never deceived by illusion like most of us are. When I suddenly realized that, I saw that I must go by what you thought and felt. You were quite sure that no one would try to poison you. You couldn't believe it. And you were right not to believe it, because it wasn't so. You never believed that Edgar would harm Lewis, and again you were right. He never would have harmed Lewis. You were sure that Gina did not love anyone but her husband, and that again was true. So, therefore, if I was to go by you, all the things that seemed to be true were only illusions. Illusions created for a definite purpose, in the same way that conjurers create illusions to deceive an audience. We were the audience. Alex Resterick got an inkling of the truth first, because he had the chance of seeing things from a different angle, from the outside angle. He was with the inspector in the drive, and he looked at the house and realized the possibilities of the windows, and he remembered the sound of running feet he'd heard that night. And then the timing of the constable showed him what a very short time things take to what we should imagine they would take. The constable panted a lot, and later, thinking of a puffing constable, I remembered that Louis Sericold was out of breath that night when he opened the study door. He'd just been running hard, you see. But it was Edgar Lawson that was the pivot of it all to me. There was always something wrong to me about Edgar Lawson. All the things he said and did were exactly right for what he was supposed to be, but he himself wasn't right. Because he was actually a normal young man playing the part of a schizophrenic. And he was always, as it were, a little larger than life. He was always theatrical. It must have all been very carefully planned and thought out. Lewis must have realized on the occasion of Christian's last visit that something had aroused his suspicions, and he knew Christian well enough to know that if he suspected, he would not rest until he had satisfied himself that his suspicions were either justified or unfounded. Carrie Louise stirred.
Yes, she said, Christiane was like that. Slow and painstaking, but actually very shrewd. I don't know what it was aroused his suspicions, but he started investigating, and he found out the truth.
The bishop said, oh, I blame myself for not having been a more conscientious trustee.
It was never expected of you to understand finance, said Carrie Louise. That was originally Mr. Guilfoyle's province. Then, when he died, Louis's great experience put him in what amounted to complete control. And that, of course, was what went to his head.
The pink color came up in her cheeks.
Louis was a great man, she said. A man of great vision, and a passionate believer in what could be accomplished with money. He didn't want it for himself, or at least not in the greedy, vulgar sense. He did want the power of it. He wanted the power to do great good with it.
He wanted, said the bishop, to be God. His voice was suddenly stern. He forgot that man is only the humble instrument of God's will.
And so he embezzled the trust funds, said Miss Marple.
Dr. Galbraith hesitated. It wasn't only that.
Tell her, said Carrie Louise. She is my oldest friend.
The bishop said, Louis Sericold was what one might call a financial wizard. In his years of highly technical accountancy, he had amused himself by working out various methods of swindling, which were practically foolproof. This had been merely an academic study, but when once he began to envisage the possibilities that a vast sum of money could encompass, he put these methods into practice. You see, he had at his disposal some first-class material. Amongst the boys who had passed through here, he chose out a small select band. They were boys whose bent was naturally criminal, who loved excitement, and who had a very high order of intelligence. Now, we've not nearly got to the bottom of it all, but it seems clear that this esoteric circle was secret and specially trained, and were later placed in key positions, where, by carrying out Lewis's directions, books were falsified in such a way that large sums of money were converted without any suspicion being aroused. I gather that the operations and the ramifications are so complicated that it will take some months before the auditors can unravel it all. But the net result seems to be that under various names and banking accounts and companies, Louis Sericold would have been able to dispose of a colossal sum with which he intended to establish an overseas colony for a cooperative experiment in which juvenile delinquents should eventually own this territory and administer it. It may have been a fantastic dream.
It was a dream that might have come true, said Carrie Louise.
Yes, it might have come true. But the means Louis Sericold adopted were dishonest means, and Christian Gulbranson discovered that. He was very upset, particularly by the realization of what the discovery and the probable persecution of Louis would mean to you, Carrie Louise.
That's why he asked me if my heart was strong and seemed so worried about my health, said Carrie Louise. I couldn't understand it.
Then Louis Sericold arrived back from the north, and Christian met him outside the house and told him that he knew what was going on. Louis took it calmly, I think. Both men agreed they must do all they could to spare you. Christian said he would write to me and ask me to come here as co-trustee to discuss the position. But of course, said Miss Marple, Louis Sericold had already prepared for this emergency. It was all planned. He had brought the young man who was to play the part of Edgar Lawson to the house. There was a real Edgar Lawson, of course, in case the police looked up his record. This false Edgar knew exactly what he had to do, act the part of a schizophrenic victim of persecution, and give Louis Sericold an alibi for a few vital minutes. The next step had been thought out, too. Louis's story that you, Carrie Louise, were being slowly poisoned. When one actually came to think of it, there was only Louis's story of what Christian had told him. That, and a few lines added on the typewriter while he was waiting for the police. It was easy to add arsenic to the tonic, and no danger for you there, since he was on the spot to prevent you drinking it. The chocolates were just an added touch. And, of course, the original chocolates weren't poisoned. Only those he substituted before turning them over to Inspector Curry. And Alex Guest, said Carrie Louise. Yes, that's why he collected your nail pairings. They would show if arsenic actually had been administered over a long period. Poor Alex. Poor Ernie. There was a moment's silence as the other two thought of Christian Gulbranson, of Alex Resterick, and of the boy Ernie, and of how quickly the act of murder could distort and deform. But surely, said the bishop, Louis was taking a big risk in persuading Edgar to be his accomplice, even if he had some hold over him. Carrie shook her head. It wasn't exactly a hold over him. Edgar was devoted to Louis. Yes, said Miss Marple. Like Leonard Wiley and his father. I wonder perhaps if... She paused delicately. You saw the likeness, I suppose, said Carrie Louise. So you knew that all along? Well, I guessed. I knew Louis had once had a short infatuation for an actress before he met me. He told me about it. It wasn't serious. She was a gold-digging type of woman, and she didn't care for him. But I've no doubt at all that Edgar was actually Louis's son. Yes, said Miss Marple. That explains everything. And he gave his life for him in the end, said Carrie Louise. She looked pleadingly at the bishop. He did, you know. There was a silence, and then Carrie Louise said, I'm glad it ended that way, with his life given in the hope of saving the boy. People who can be very good can be very bad, too. I always knew that was true about Louis. But he loved me very much, and I loved him. Did you ever suspect him? Asked Miss Marple. No, said Carrie Louise. Because I was puzzled by the poisoning. I knew Louis would never poison me, and yet that letter of Christian said definitely that someone was poisoning me. So I thought that everything I thought I knew about people must be wrong. Miss Marple said, But when Alex and Ernie were found killed, you suspected then? Yes, said Carrie Louise. Because I didn't think anyone else but Louis would have dared. And I began to be afraid of what he might do next. She shivered slightly. I admired Louis. I admired his... what shall I call it? His goodness? But I do see that if you're good, you have to be humble as well. Dr. Galbraith said gently.
That, Carrie Louise, is what I have always admired in you. Your humility.
The lovely blue eyes opened wide in surprise.
But I'm not clever, and not particularly good. I can only admire goodness in other people.
Dear Carrie Louise, said Miss Marple.
Epilogue. I think Grandam will be quite all right with Aunt Mildred, said Gina. Aunt Mildred seems much nicer now. Not so peculiar, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, said Miss Marple.
So Wally and I will go back to the States in a fortnight's time.
Gina cast a look sideways at her husband.
I shall forget all about Stonegates and Italy and all my girlish past and become 100% American. Our son will always be addressed as Junior. I can't say fairer than that, can I, Wally?
You certainly cannot, Kate, said Miss Marple.
Wally, smiling indulgently at an old lady who got names wrong, corrected her gently.
It's Gina, not Kate.
But Gina laughed.
She knows what she's saying. You see, she'll call you Petruchio in a moment.
I just think, said Miss Marple to Walter, that you have acted very wisely, my dear boy.
She thinks you're just the right husband for me, said Gina.
Miss Marple looked from one to the other. It was very nice, she thought, to see two young people so much in love. And Walter Hudd was completely transformed from the sulky young man she had first encountered into a good-humoured, smiling giant.
You two remind me, she said, of...
Gina rushed forward and placed a hand firmly over Miss Marple's mouth.
No, darling, she exclaimed, don't say it. I'm suspicious of these village parallels. They've always got a sting in the tail. You really are a wicked old woman, you know?
Her eyes went misty.
When I think of you and Aunt Ruth and Grandam all being young together, how I wonder what you were all like. I can't imagine it somehow.
I don't suppose you can, said Miss Marple. It was all a long time ago.
That was Rosemary Leach reading They Do It With Mirrors by Agatha Christie.